Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Welcome new listeners. My guess is we'll get a few first-timers because of my guest, Hazel Barton. We'll get to her in just a few minutes. Chances are, if you're here, you're already a caver, but if you're not one yet and you're interested, first of all, welcome. You'll find some of the most interesting people you'll ever meet are cavers. I'm glad you're curious about it. Also, make sure if you're going to go caving for the first time that you do it with other cavers. It's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. You can get lost or hurt if you're not doing it right. Whereas if you do know what you're doing, it's very safe. It's like a lot of things. But for some reason, people tend to get cocky about going into caves and bad things happen. So welcome, but make sure you're doing it right. And you heard me mention my grotto. That's a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. You can go to their website, caves.org, easy to remember, caves.org, and find a list of grottos by state. So you can find the one closest to you and get started making some contacts. You'll find that a lot of cavers, especially those in grotto leadership, are more than happy to help you find a group you can tag along with. And now this. A supporter of the podcast asked that we highlight a different karst conservancy every month. And so this month, I want to touch on the work being done by the Michigan Karst Conservancy. This one's actually in our periphery at the CIG. One of our longtime members, former NSS president Tom Ray, is one of the trustees of the Michigan Karst Conservancy. And so we've seen a few programs on the MKC at grotto meetings, and we get to hear all about them. The most recent one was kind of a history of the Fiborn Quarry, where the MKC's Fiborn Karst Preserve is now. Pretty interesting stuff. This quarry that operated for just a little over 30 years after the turn of the 20th century, and you can read up on that history at their website, or you can get Mark Whitney's book, Fiborn Quarry, Then and Now, for $15 plus postage. All of that can be done at their website, which is hosted by the NSS, at caves.org/conservancy/MKC, or just search Michigan Karst Conservancy. Of course, they own the Fiborn. They also own Thunder Bay Karst Preserve, which includes the Mystery Valley Karst Preserve expansion. A lot of good conservation being done by the MKC. And as you might imagine, it's an overlooked part of the country where caves and karst are concerned. So I think you'll be impressed by what they've done there. If you'd like to support it, you can become a member. They have many tiers, of course. From individual member all the way to one-time dues life membership. Or, of course, you can just make a donation. Again, go to caves.org/conservancy/MKC or just search Michigan Karst Conservancy. Well, another month without caving for me. I know a lot of people went to convention in Tennessee, and I actually saw a big listenership bump that week. I get weekly emails telling me how many plays and downloads I get, and I was really surprised to see a big bump and was trying to figure it out, and I realized it was convention week. So thanks for listening down in Cookeville. I wish I could have been down there with you, but yeah, no caving for me. I had a trip planned the weekend before convention, and the weather turned bad here, and we were just going to do some pit bouncing, and I'd rather just not do that when it's pouring down rain, so I stayed home. Some hardier folks are shaking your heads right now, and I fully accept that response. It's just, I have a 2-year-old and a very pregnant wife at home, and I'd hate to saddle her with the boy to go on a trip that I only half enjoyed because the weather sucked. So there's my excuse. I did just get back, literally, the day this was posted. I'm sleepy and jet-lagged from the Pacific Northwest. We were going to hike around Mount St. Helens for 4 days. My good friend Eric and I, he lives out there. We had permits for 3 nights in the backcountry at specific campsites and whatnot, but the weather was bad there too. So we went to Crater Lake instead and did some day hikes there and near Bend, and then Mount St. Helens yesterday on Sunday. It was a good weekend. Good sleep, great food, bad conditions. We got eaten up by mosquitoes in Crater Lake. Kind of surprising that they were this bad this early. Then on one of the hikes near Bend, we got 20 minutes in and it started hailing. I believe it was the Black Crater Trail, 4-mile hike up the mountain, then 4 miles back, and the conditions just really never got better. So we turned around after a couple miles and we heard thunder and saw lightning, and we ended up doing another hike down the road. So we ate better and we slept better, and we had a lot more beer than we would have had we backpacked like we planned. So no complaints here. This was kind of my last hurrah before baby waiting time. Wonderful little trip. Not to keep talking about myself, but I mentioned in the last episode that I had gotten a promotion at work, and now I'm at liberty to share those details with you because it is relevant. So when I started this podcast, I did it as sort of a fun exercise more than anything. I'm a radio professional. This month I celebrate 20 years in radio, And I started doing this podcast to sharpen my interviewing and editing skills. And I had no idea it was going to take off in the caving world the way it has. And I'm delighted to share with you that it has now helped me achieve a dream of mine, and that is to host a radio talk show. Last month, I found out I'm going to be hosting a five-day-a-week statewide talk show on public radio stations, basically NPR affiliates in Indiana, starting this fall. I'll be hosting twice a week here in town starting this month, and then we go statewide in October. So in a very real way, this podcast has really helped me professionally. So thank you for listening, and thank you for your emails and your comments and your suggestions. If I haven't gotten to your email, my apologies. I get a lot of them, and so it's really nice. I'm a caver with basically zero cred, with the only exception being that I host this podcast and occasionally go caving recreationally. So it feels really special that this has come to pass, and I really do have cavers to thank for it. So thank you. Well, here goes. I mentioned this early on, but it's worth repeating here that I started this podcast with Hazel Barton on a short list of dream guests. And when I finally reached out to her in early 2018, we had a short correspondence. And that was it. She finally got back with me about a year later and agreed to do the podcast on the condition that I speak with more female cavers, which I'd already begun doing, luckily enough, just coming off the interview with Renee Ohms and Johanna Kovarik. So we talked over Skype, and it was just great. She's a brilliant, fascinating person, as you know, and if you've ever come across her, you know that. She's been featured on the IMAX documentary Journey into Amazing Caves. We talk about that. More recently, she's been featured on the National Geographic series One Strange Rock, which you can see on Netflix. She was in episode 4, titled Genesis, and she's just an incredible caver, and I'll let her tell you more. Here's me and Hazel Barton. Let me just start by saying that when I started this podcast, I had a list in mind of a few pie-in-the-sky guests, and you were at the top or near the top of that list. So thank you for coming on, Dr. Hazel Barton.
Oh, that must have been a short list.
I mean, it was the short top list.
Well, I'm flattered that you are interested in talking to me. I have to be honest, when you first asked me, I was like, oh, people are so, I'm sick of hearing about me. So I can't imagine that anyone else still wants to hear about me. But then I've listened to some podcasts. It's really great because I'm kind of up in the middle of nowhere in Ohio and I don't get to hang with a lot of my friends. So I can hear you talking to a lot of my friends and the stories that, you know, I've heard around the campfire or not heard around the campfire. So it's been kind of fun. So I thought, well, maybe somebody will actually ask me something that no one has asked me before, or I could tell you stories that, you know, people who go caving with me hear all the time, but never make it into the public realm. And I guess the, so I have two personas. I have the professional persona and I have the caving persona. And, it sounds kind of weird, like schizophrenic, but, so I have a fairly high position, an academic position. And I, you know, I run a large PhD program and I have a lot of students that work for me. And I also like to go caving and I go caving with those students. And it, I have to draw a line between the fact that I'm their boss. And then when I'm going caving, I want to be a caver.
You're like and a crazy person. You turn into a crazy person.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
And like, I've been caving since I was 14. And so when you grow up caving, you know, you can take the girl out of the cave, but you can't take the cave out of the girl. So I have to draw this line. I have to sit down and have like these talks with the students like, okay, we're going to go caving and I'm going to completely change. And that does not mean I'm going to be your friend when we get back to work. When I get back to work, I'm going to be your boss again. And it's I didn't used to have this conversation and it would really mess with these students' minds because they're all of a sudden they're like, oh, Hazel's my best friend. It's like, no, I'm not. I am letting my hair down. You just happen to be around when that's happening. So, yeah, if hopefully you can edit out any naughty words that I accidentally drop them if I'm in caver persona. I'll try not to because I, you know, if this is published and people listen to it. I don't want to lose my job, so I'll try to be careful.
I want both. I want a little bit of both personas. You don't have to switch between the two because I know that they're not mutually exclusive. speaking of Ohio, so this is kind of a personal thing. I grew up next to Ohio, but I'm a lifelong Hoosier, Indiana resident. Are there any caves worthwhile in Ohio?
Oh well, that's the caveat, isn't it? Worthwhile. People were like, oh, there's some caves. There's 300 caves in Ohio. And I'm like, you're kidding me, right? They'll take you to the longest one and it's been dug out. The entire thing's been dug out. It's Ohio Caverns, I think. And I went there one time and everybody was excited for me to go there. And they've literally dug a trench through a cave that was filled to the ceiling with mud. And you can walk through basically a 6 foot deep trench of mud. And then they point out formations to you. And all the formations are about 3 or 4 inches high because that's the gap between the ceiling and the top of the mud. So you're like peering. And I'm like, what is this? And so there's a ton of limestone. I mean, like if you look at a geologic map, Ohio it's all, I don't know, 60, 70% limestone. But it's covered with 30 feet of alluvial fill. And so every cave there is just got, you know, it just like a bulldozer came through and filled it full of crud. So I'm sure, you know, should there be a massive geologic epoch that somehow scrapes that off and cleans the caves out, I'm sure there'd be something interesting there. But it's a bad combination of living 6 hours from decent caves and also being an academic, which makes it hard to get away. So I did not move here for the caves, if that makes sense.
it makes perfect sense. Yeah. I just find it interesting that a caver of your stature would end up in Ohio, but they do have a terrific program there, and you're running it well.
Yeah, they treat me like a princess. So, I would say that I have enough benches in my lab. I have two large labs. And I have a dedicated white nose lab, which is on in a completely different building because obviously I go to caves all over the world. I don't want any white nose anywhere near all my other gear. So I have a separate room in a separate building, and I have two large lab spaces. So I think I can sit 24 people in my lab, which is, you know, a phenomenal amount of accommodation for me. They gave me a large startup and I've got 17 people working for me. And it would be hard to go somewhere that would support me in the way that my university supports me. And so there was a job in Alabama and I was like, oh God, the job in Alabama. But it was administrative. So I have a semi-administrative role now, which is a bit of a time seek, but I love it because I get to work with the students. And this would be a lot more administrated, so I wouldn't get to do as much research. So it was kind of like research caves, and the research one. So yeah, I would have, oh my God, having a job in Huntsville, Alabama, how wouldn't that be fantastic? I was like, literally, I got to drive 6 hours to a cave. I think they have a cave on campus. Oh my God. But yeah, no, I'm stuck up here I'm not going to say anything horrible about Ohio. It's nice.
No, it is nice. It's very nice up there. I mean,
yeah,
you've got terrific outdoor areas. You've got some great state forests and things like that. Great for mm-hmm. hiking. And mm-hmm. I mean, you're up there near Cuyahoga National Park. And so, you know, that's cool. But as far as caves, it's just a little lacking. But
yeah, at least I'm not in Louisiana or something. I mean, there are, you know, and well, we had an argument at the grotto about whether your feet would actually be out of sunlight if you were in most of the caves in Ohio. And there was some discussion that it wouldn't matter as long as your head was out of sunlight.
A lot of shelter caves with that sort of half-moon map, quote unquote. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess let's go back to the beginning. Let's start from the beginning. How did you get started caving?
So I was very heroic and I went into caves. No. So the first time I ever slept in a tent, I think I was 19. I was a city girl. And so my parents.
And the city was?
Oh, Bristol in England.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so my parents were not outdoorsy at all. I don't think my mother has ever slept in a tent. I'm not sure that my dad has ever slept in a tent. We had a caravan, one of these big heavy things you pull behind the car, and that was what my mom considered camping. You know, this thing had a kitchen and a toilet and a shower and everything. But that was camping. So, and I was a city girl, and I never really did anything. And then when I was 14, they had this program. They got this program in the UK called Outward Bound. And they take a bunch of city kids and they let them go free in the wild to see what happens to them. We did, you know, horse riding and rock climbing and kayaking and orienteering and caving. It's kind of interesting. There was like, I think, glimmers of Hazel actually being a little bit brave when I was younger. I was in the Girl Scouts, and the Girl Scout group was run by my mother. And as I said, she wasn't outdoorsy. So the Girl Scout group I was in, it was like we'd go knitting or we'd do crochet or we'd learn how to use a sewing machine, right? It's a very gender specific kind of approach to guiding. But we did have some guide camps. And I remember one time we went to this guide camp and they were going to teach us how to rappel. And we were all stood on a line and they said, who wants to go first? And I remember standing there going, oh, I'm not going to go first. And like literally everybody else in the line stepped backwards. And so I was like, oh my God. And then they're like, okay, here you go. Put the harness on. And I remember being shaking. And then I was like, well, I'm just going to go for it. You know, I'm here. I'll go for it. And I rappelled it. It was, I don't know, 20-foot cliff, something like that, on a figure eight with someone hanging on for dear life at the end. And I remember going down and being like, well, that was fun. And so I got in the back of the line. I was the only person able to do it twice. I was like, this is all right. So when I was 14, we did this Outward Bound. And I was actually, you know, even though I've always thought myself was quite timid at that age, I think there must have been a little bit of me that was a little bit adventurous. But anyway, we did the caving and I was just like instantly hooked. I was like, wow, this is, I don't know what it is about this place, but this is fun. And there were about 30 of us with this one guide, and it was Clearwater Cavern, which is in the Forest of Dean, which is a pretty small, pretty easy cave, standard beginner cave. But of course, you know, it's your first ever cave. There was crawling and climbing, and everybody was absolutely petrified. And it was a bunch of kids like a gaggle behind the guide. Like everybody wanted to be within, you know, like 3 or 4 feet of this guy so they wouldn't get lost. And so I got kind of shuffled to the back, and I was totally cool with that. I thought that was just fine. I was just wandering around looking at stuff. I thought this was great. And then there was a kid who ended up getting further and further back because his light went out. And the guide was, you know, surrounded by these kids, was completely oblivious to the situation. And I just remember taking my helmet off, and so we could hold it between us so we could figure out what we're doing. So not only was I like cool with it, I was cool enough to actually take my light off and be very brave about it. So that was when I was 14. And then when I was 16, I was doing my A-levels in England. So A-levels is kind of like, I'm not sure what the equivalent is, but it's your entrance exams for university. So if you've ever seen Harry Potter, they do ordinary levels and advanced wizard levels.
Sure,
so this
sure.
is A-level, which is equivalent to advanced wizard, right. And one of the teachers, the special ed teachers at my school, was the chair of the Wessex Cave Club at the time. And so he said, well, does anyone want to go caving? And we had to take a sports elective on Wednesday afternoons. It was just basically like noon to whenever. And I could do netball, or I could do field hockey, or I could go in a cave. And I remembered how much I enjoyed that first experience. I'm like, well, I'm going to go caving. So I show up and, you know, mum kitted me out, which was like mum's idea of what outdoorsy should be. Which is my coveralls were white. She found some coveralls somewhere. I don't know where she dug them out, and they were white. And I do remember the one thing is I'd come back from caving trips, and she'd scrub and scrub and scrub and scrub trying to get those things white again. I have no idea why she thought they needed to stay white. But anyway, so we did a caving trip, and we went to a cave called Goat Church. And I've taken my stepkids back there, and I'm like, oh my God, this thing is so easy. But at the time, it was like, this was like the most epic experience of my life. And they had this thing called the coal chute. And it is, it's just a flowstone slope. It's about 20 feet long, I think. But it's pretty steep, maybe 60, 70 degrees.
Wow.
And it's had a million Boy Scout bottoms go down it. So it is smooth as glass. And so there's a rope down it. And what you do is you body rappel, because there's nothing that'll keep your feet under you. You just kind of body rappel down this thing. But of course, I knew nothing about ropes. I knew nothing about body rappelling. All I knew was that somebody flung a rope down this hole and I should go down it. So I grab onto the rope. I've got no gloves on or anything. And I put my feet down, and then I think I get down about 2 or 3 feet, and then whoosh, my feet go out from underneath me. So all my body weight is on my hands. My hands kind of like shoot up as my body drops down the rope, and then I'm dangling by my hands on the rope. And then slowly my hands start to slide down the rope, and I know enough to know if I hold on, I'm going to burn my hands badly. So I did what every normal person in that situation would do, is I just simply let go. And so I must have fallen, you know, my feet were probably a good 12 feet off the ground, and I just went, whoosh. And the teacher caught me at the bottom. He was amazing. He kind of caught me. It's like one of those, like in The Princess Bride, where she jumps and he kind of just catches her in his arms. He kind of caught me like that. And then I bowled him over. And there was a big mess of us in the, you know, arms and legs in the boulder chamber below. And he just was like, just from the look on his face, it's like, what the f*** are you doing? And I was a bit shaken, but I was like, okay, well, that was all right. What's next? And we got into this thing that was called the vice or the pinch or something like that. And I've gone back several times, and this thing is tight. This is probably only about 8 or 9 inches high.
Wow.
And it's a Z-bend. And to go in and go out, you have to commit to go all the way through. And there's a small room on the other side you can turn around and come back. So even after falling down the coal chute, I actually, you know, still went ahead and did this really tight squeeze with a Z-bend. And this is fun. This is all right. And I didn't realize it, but there were five other, it was all guys. I was the only girl that did this. And there were five other guys on the trip. And they were taking bets on how long I would stay caving. And so the longest anyone gave me was 6 weeks. And how long has that been now? I'm trying to think. That's 32 years ago.
Way off. They were way off.
They were way off. So, yeah. So, yeah, I think I outcaved all of them, so that was all right.
Well, how did it become more than a hobby? Like, at what point did things turn?
So when I was in graduate school, I was, oh my God, I went caving all the time.
But okay, so when you were in graduate, so this was you're on the microbiology track.
My PhD is medical microbiology. Okay. I was never supposed to do this. I was like, I was on track to be my PhD is medical microbiology and immunology, right? So no environmental, no geology, no nothing.
Interesting.
Yeah. And my advisor, we have them in academia. I do them all the time now, but we call them come to Jesus talks, which mm-hmm. is where somebody sits you down and said, now, okay, this is the way it's going to be. And you either, you know, come into the fold or you're going to be lost forever. And I was caving every weekend through graduate school. I remember if I took 2 weekends off, I was like, oh, something's gone horribly wrong. And we did everything. Oh, my God, all the caves I mapped in Colorado, all the stuff we did at Wing Cave. Oh, my God, the quads. It was just absolutely glorious. But my advisor was like, this is bad. You're never going to be successful if you spend all your time caving. You need to focus on your work. And at the time I was like, oh, you know, no, I can do both. But I think it probably did set me back a bit, but who cares, right? Because it's glorious.
Well, you've melded both of these things together in a beautiful way.
I have, but only when I was given permission to do it. And so I really tried to keep them separate. So science was very siloed at the time where, you know, if you were a chemist, you're a chemist. If you were a microbiologist, you were a microbiologist. You didn't do chemical microbiology, right? It was one or the other. And so the idea of integrating something that you were passionate about with your science was more like, well, you're just using your science to advance your hobby. And that was something that really bothered me. I did see people who had some scientific background going into cave and say, you know, I am this scientist, let me in. And then nothing ever came of it. And so hobbyist science was, you know, had a bad rap, which was insane because you have people like Donald Davis back then. And, you know, Donald has done more for the science of speleology than anyone else as a hobbyist. So it was crazy. Anyway, so I did that. I got my PhD. I did a postdoc. I did heart research because I was so sick of bacteria, and then spent 2 years doing heart research and realized that, you know, the only thing I really understood were bacteria. So I went and got a postdoc with a guy called Norm Pace. And I don't know if you know Norm. He's an old Indiana caver.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole section of Buckner Cave named after him that he dug out. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I want to talk to him, too.
Oh, you should. Norm is.
I would love to.
Oh, fantastic. I'll hook you up.
That'd be great.
So anyway, I went to work for Norm, and Norm hired me as a postdoc. You know, it's really, Norm's like one of the top labs in the world for what he does. And it's like, he took me on. I'm like, I couldn't believe this guy took me on. I said, well, why did you hire me? He said, well, you're a caver. I like the way cavers think. And I was like, all right. And he'd actually read my articles. I wrote a lot in the Colorado Grotto newsletter, and he'd read them. And he said, you sound like a good writer. You sound interesting. Why don't you come work for me? So it was Norm that gave me permission to mix the two. He said that, you know, because we talked about it and said, well, I couldn't possibly do that. You know, I can't diminish my science by making it about caves. And he's like, well, why the hell not? You have a PhD in microbiology and you can go in caves where an awful lot of people can't. Why don't you just go see what's there? And it was just like, in this transformative moment in my life, it's like, well, holy shit, I can go do that. And then exactly at the same time, the IMAX thing happened. And so somebody's paying for me to go to caves and look at microbiology. And I'm like, well, hang on a minute. And it just kind of happened. I mean, it was life imitating art, which was kind of weird because I hadn't really seriously got into the cave microbiology when that IMAX thing came along. But then, you know, I actually made the mistake of actually trying to do microbiology while we were doing that thing. But it's just, you can't support it. There's no logistics. The paperwork is a mess. You know, samples get destroyed because they prioritize all the film equipment. So it was more of going through the motions of sampling versus what we do right now, which nobody would ever want to film because, you know, the actual mundane aspects of sitting there processing samples in a cave is really pretty boring. But it was really weird because the IMAX came right about the time that I started to do the cave microbiology. So it just kind of, it's like, oh my God, here I go. And that was it.
So that's so interesting to me. Of course, you're referring to the IMAX documentary, Journey into Amazing Caves. And it's crazy to me that that sort of set things in motion because the way that that was presented, I've seen the film, it was as if this had been going on for some time, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, it seems like it really worked in your favor to do this kind of work.
Yeah. I know.
It was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, I'd like to say that I'm this genius that came up with this. I'm like, no, I accidentally, I just tripped into it. Is what it feels like. You know what they say that? What is it they say? Luck is preparedness meets opportunity, and I think that's what it was. So, did the IMAX that came out in 2001, and then I got my first faculty position in 2003. And when I was interviewing for jobs, you know, I had to describe what my research was. So I just went for it. I'm like, I am a cave microbiologist. This is what I do. This is how I do it. And I'd had a couple of publications by then. So, you know, it wasn't all smoke and mirrors. I actually had something to stand on. But as soon as I had my own lab and I'm calling the shots, it's like, we've gone for it. And I've been very lucky. I got some super talented people in. I do have to be careful because when I started out, people would come to want to work for me because they were cavers and they thought this was a great way to mix their hobby with like a career. But people were coming in interested in the caves and not interested in the science. And the one thing that we absolutely do in the lab is everything has to be driven by a scientific question. I don't care how cool the cave is. If it's not driven by the science first, we're just not going to do it. We can't afford it. You know, my lab spends, I mean, the budget my lab runs anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000 a year, just keeping the lab going.
Wow, yeah.
And so we simply can't. We have to get grant funding in to do anything. And if you're going to be competitive for grants, you've got to have a really strong scientific story. So it's always been driven by the science. And I got burnt a few times with people coming in that, you know, they'd be great in the cave and they collect samples and they do that and they get back to the lab. And nothing happened. It's like, well, the sample being processed? No, nothing's happened. Have you done this? No. A couple of times, you know, we had stuff submitted for meetings. And, you know, 3 weeks before the meeting, we turn around and somebody's done nothing for 6 months. They were all keen to do the cave, but they weren't keen to do the lab. So now I really make sure that the people that I'm hiring, it's science first. So they really, they're interested in pursuing the science, and the caving is kind of icing on the cake. But it is a challenge because a lot of the caves we work in are fairly extreme, whether they're just technically difficult like Lechuguilla, or, you know, we work in Brazil and Venezuela, China. I mean, these are hard caves to get to. So you really need to be on your game as well. So I've got a couple of students right now, a couple of PhD students right now who are like solid, like world-class cavers. But, you know, they went through the ringer trying to convince me they were into the science before I brought them into the lab. And of course, now they get all expenses paid trips to Lechuguilla, so they're pretty happy. Yeah.
You had mentioned WNS, and thank you for the work that you're doing there. When that sort of came on the scene, you had been a caver for quite a long time. I mean, what was that? That was 2006 or so when it came to the States, and you started to see it sort of take hold out east. I mean, what did you did? Were you filled with dread to a degree?
I think so. I remember hearing about it. I remember Emily talking about the first White Nose conference and it kind of getting on my radar through Emily Davis, and didn't think much about it. And then it jumped to, I think it was Virginia first. And then it's like, well, hang on a minute, because if it's local, you can think of it being an environmental effect, like, you know, someone's dumped some kind of weird organic pesticide and all these bats have been it contaminated and there's some weird die-off related to it. But when it jumps, you know, several hundred miles, it's an infectious disease. And as soon as it made that jump, I was like, this is, oh my God, what is going on? And I called up David Blayhart, who was the guy who first identified the fungus that was responsible, because we had no idea for a couple of years. And I said, well, what can I do? And he's like, you need to figure out a way to kill this thing because we need to decontaminate. And so that's how I launched into it in 2008. But to be honest, I'm sick of the politics of it. It was really, and this is going to sound absolutely terrible to say, but it was exciting to be on the forefront of an emerging infectious epidemic like that, because nobody knew anything. And every experiment you did told you something. Every meeting you went to, they were small meetings, you know, 30, 40 people. And that was the total of people that were interested. Nobody cared about this thing when it was in the beginning. And everybody would exchange ideas. And it was just so dynamic and fast moving and responsive. And the Fish and Wildlife Service were throwing a lot of money at it. And so there was a lot of funding. And as soon as that funding hit, it started to draw in people that otherwise wouldn't have been interested. And then it started to get competitive. It started to get a bit backstabby. It started to get a little bit political. And I honestly can't stand White Nose. Not just because of the devastating effect it's had, but the response that I've seen, so many decisions made that were not based on science. Like, we're giving them the data, we're presenting them the data, and if it doesn't fit like the strategic plan, then it either gets kind of filed away or ignored. And I'm not going to go into details on it. It's not the place to do that. I mean, if anyone wants to ask me, you know, we can sit down and have a beer and talk about it. But it's so incredibly frustrating as a scientist to see decisions made not on the best information, but because it's politically appropriate to do that. And so I think one of the examples is keeping cavers out of caves. There's everything that suggests that humans move it is anecdotal. There's a ton of information that shows it's bat-to-bat transfer. When they did the original white nose experiment to show how bats were contaminated, they had a cage of bats that had white nose, and then they had a cage of bats that were exactly 1 foot away, open bars. The bats couldn't touch each other, but, you know, they're basically in the same, you know, incubator with each other. And the bats that could not come in contact with the white nose infected bats never got the disease. Only when they took them out of that cage and put them in with the positive bats did they become infected. So it's hard for this thing to jump, but if a bat has it, I've seen some videos where you have a bat in a hibernation cluster, and there'll be 900 animals in that hibernation cluster. And you can spot the white-nosed bat because its body temperature is elevated. And you see this little red dot squirming about, and it will come into contact with every single bat in that cluster over the course of a season. And so, you know, that is a really obvious way that it's being moved, but there's only anecdotal evidence that the people do it. And yet you can't tell a bat you're not allowed to go across state lines. You can't go in that cave. You can't do this. You can't do that. And so the only management strategy people have is to keep cavers out. And it's had absolutely no effect because there's absolutely no evidence that it does anything. So that is, yeah, I've fought so many battles on that. I've sat in so many meetings, and I've got into a meeting and sat down. You know, it's been a two and a half hour meeting. And as soon as I've sat down, within 30 seconds, I know that nothing we can say is going to change their mind, because the only management activities they can do is to control humans. They can't do anything about the bats. And so they're just simply not there to listen to what you have to say. So that's been very, very frustrating. And honestly, I've moved away from it. Lots of people are like, I get so frustrated. I get introduced. Oh, this is Hazel Barton. She's the bat lady. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I do an awful lot of work, and white nose is probably 15% of what we do in my lab. But, you know, I'm not going to correct anyone. It's like, fine, introduce me as the bat lady. But oh God, yeah.
Yeah, as if it's the only thing that you do. And I see so many parallels here to the way politics are on a broader level. You know, people sort of taking knee-jerk reactions to deal with something, to at least make it appear like they're doing something about this, when really what they're doing is having no effect.
Yeah, I think then, and that was what it is they had to appear to do something. They had to be appearing to stop it. But you can't, I mean, there is not a single, these emerging infectious mycoses is what we call them, EIM. I've done a lot of work with the National Science Foundation about them because of my white nose research. But, you know, there's a lot of these mycoses. You look at the chytrid fungus in the frogs. You look at what's happening to bananas. Look at what's happened to coffee beans. You know, these mycoses get in and they, like, wipe out entire populations, whether it be plants or animals. And there's not a single human intervention that has stopped the progress of one of these diseases. And yet, you know, the things, oh my God, this is a great story. I'm not going to say who it was, but I was with a game warden for a very large state. And we were doing, I've done a lot of white nose research. I've grabbed a lot of bats off of walls and played around with bats. And we went to a white nose cave. And I have like I said, I have a dedicated lab, and I actually have a dedicated set of caving gear, right? So everybody in my lab, we have a stash of white nose gear, and it's in a box in that lab, and it only stays in that lab. And so we take it into the field, and it's just dedicated white nose syndrome gear. And when we went to this cave, it's a white nose site, and I'm not going to say how devastating it is to walk through one of those, but you're literally ankle deep in decomposing bat carcasses. It's just a terrible thing. So anyway, we go in, we do our research, and we come out, and he's got this entire decontamination set up outside of his truck. And there's all like these plastic bags down, and you know, this is plastic bag one, you step on this and you shed this layer, and then this is plastic bag two, and you step on this, you shed that layer. And then this is plastic bag three, and you're down to your underwear at this point. And you're going to rub this on your hands and this on your face, and you're going to squirt this in your hair. And I'm like, God, none of this is going to do anything, whatever. And then you can step off the plastic, and then, you know, this goes in this box that gets segregated, and this goes in this box that gets segregated, and then the boxes all get decontaminated around the outside, and then it gets, everybody gets sprayed down with Lysol, the boxes get sprayed down with Lysol, you put it in the back of the truck, you know, there's all this, like, and it's this huge palaver. It takes like an hour to get out your kit and get in the car. It's like, okay, fine. And then I went back with him a year later after the disease had like blown through the state, and we get back to the car, and he strips off his coveralls, throws them in the back of the car, and jumps in the driver's seat. And I'm standing there. I'm like, are we not going to contaminate? It's like, ah, it's too late. It's like, we went from this hour long process to just like, ah, check it in the back. It'll be fine.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty wild.
What is your level of optimism on whether or not bat or when, maybe I should say, bat populations will or could recover from this?
Well, it's evolution, right? We're looking at an evolutionary process. This is no different than, you know, any large wildlife epidemic that's gone through a population. So there are remnants communities. The bats that survive behave differently. They don't cluster. They hibernate individually. They're larger animals. So what's happened is susceptible populations have died out, and the remnant populations are going to repopulate. And that's just how evolution works. And so I think, I'm trying to remember, there was one cave that we were in, and it used to have 300,000 bats in it or something. And we went back, and we were supposed to be swabbing white-nosed bats. And we were in there for about 6 hours, and we found 17 bats. For that entire 6 hours.
Wow.
But that's 17 bats. That's the population that recovers. And you start to see other species bouncing back, right? So Virginia big-eared bats are doing better. And now all the little browns and the pips are gone because there's more food for the Virginia big-eared. So you see niche space open, right? So ecological windows for other organisms to come in and fill. But the trouble is with bats is they have such a low fecundity. So that, you know, you have one offspring a year, and there's a 50% mortality rate for that one offspring. And I think the population grows, I can't remember what it is. It's like less than 6% a year in a good year. So if you look at the size of the remnant population that exists now, and you take that 6% population growth and you project it forward, it's going to be 10,000 years for recovery.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's just how biology works. And, you know, I don't want to be unsympathetic here, but that's just the way that the biology is going to repair this. There's going to have to be adaptation, and there's going to have to be selection. And you know, I know I'm going to get a million emails yelling at me now, but that's just the way it's going to be. And it's going to blow through, and the populations are going to be affected, and people are going to run around squirting Lysol over boxes and spending hours decontaminating. It's not going to have any effect. You just have to let biology kick in. And we're in the, you know, the sixth great extinction event. I mean, this is all being driven by human activity. So the cavers may not specifically be driving the spread of white nose, but human activity led to those bats ending up in the United States. So there's a lot of, I think there's 6 or 7 published articles about bats, Asian bats being found in California. And so they get blown off course, they land on a ship, they end up in a shipping container, and they end up in California. So it's known that, you know, they can cross the Pacific that way. And I was at a white nose conference in, I think we were in Texas, and someone showed up with a Ziploc bag with a bat in it. And it had been found in a shipping container in Tennessee, and it was dead. And they wanted to know what kind of bat it was. And it was a French species, I believe. So, you know, there was a bat that hibernated in the shipping container that ended up on a ship, that ended up on a train that went as far as Tennessee, and they opened it up, and the bat was dead. So you can see how, you know, human-driven transportation is responsible for this. And plus climate change, you know, you've got ecosystems that are getting warmer, that are changing the patterns of animal behavior, and you get different animals coming into contact with different pathogens. So this isn't restricted to white nose syndrome. I mean, we're living through the great sixth great extinction event, but we're also driving that. So yeah, we maybe get off the hook as cavers, but not as human beings, unfortunately.
You're right about that. All right, let's move into another part of your line of work. You were talking about Lechuguilla earlier, and we'll talk plenty about Lechuguilla, I hope. How valuable has Lechuguilla been to the world of microbiology specifically?
Oh, it launched it. Modern cave microbiology was born in Lechuguilla Cave.
Okay, see, because I get this perception before having been told this just now, that lech sort of gets a disproportionate amount of attention. I thought probably just because it's pretty and because it's, you know, one of the top mineral cave discoveries of, you know, of the last generation. But now hearing this, that's very interesting to me to hear that this is sort of the frontier.
So Lechuguilla is hypogenic, right? So if you think about, you know, Indiana caves, the majority of caves, they're formed by, you know, meteoric water. So rainwater percolating through the ground, cracks going into the vadose zone down the phreatic zone, right? So you've got a lot of surface input. A lot of them are either springs or sinks. And that's a lot of energy coming in. And that's where most cave microbiology had been done, in systems like that. And the microbes that you see that way are related to surface species. And the reason we see that is because there is a connection, right? There's a geologic connection. There's a conduit from the surface into the subsurface. And also a lot of the tools and techniques that were historically used were used for soil microbes. So if you use the same technique that you would use to find a soil microbe, then you find something that looks like a soil microbe in a cave and you just say, well, caves are just contaminated with stuff that we've brought in. And that was pretty much what people believed, that caves were dead. There was nothing interesting in there. And if you did find something interesting in there, it either came in through a river or a stream or on somebody's boot. And then in the 90s, I think it was 1991, Kim Cunningham, who was a scientist, I think in Colorado, started doing electron microscopy on samples from Lechuguilla, like corrosion residues and ferromanganese deposits that were isolated more than 1,000 feet underground in a hypogenic cave, right? So Lechuguilla formed from water rising from below, so there was no conduit to the surface. And there's also a pretty thick sandstone cap rock that prevents water coming in. So they've done some measurements with tritiated water at Carlsbad, and most of the places that we're sampling in Lechuguilla, it takes 10,000 years for rainwater to get to that point in the cave.
Wow.
So incredibly isolated.
Yeah.
And there's no way anything was being brought in, right? These were pristine samples from passages that had just been discovered. So there's no way it was contamination. And Kim was looking because he wanted to see what the mineralogy was, and it was like, bam, there were microbes everywhere. And everybody kind of looked around and said, there's an endemic population of microbes here. And all of a sudden it was like, well, where did they come from? And it just launched the field. So what I've been doing since I started is I've been trying to understand why there are so many of them there, how they're making their living. They're so isolated. Most of Lechuguilla, where we're studying, is so isolated from the surface, there's not enough energy to support protozoa. You know, forget mammals, forget insects. You know, there's not even enough energy to support single-celled eukaryotes. It's bacteria and archaea living in there and some scant fungi. So how the hell do they do that? And that's what my lab, that's our primary goal. That's what a lot of our funding has been towards. That's where the antibiotic stuff has come out as well. They fight each other for resources. So it's just absolutely fascinating. But yeah, Lech launched. Modern cave microbiology would not exist if Lechuguilla hadn't convinced people that microbes are there to begin with, not because they've been brought in.
Well, and I watched your TED Talk. And by the way, if you, the listener, have not seen Dr. Barton's TED Talk about exploration, go find it. Anyway, I noticed a detail that you didn't expound upon in the talk because it would have distracted from the larger point you were making about exploration, but you found a new antibiotic in Lechuguilla.
Yeah.
Has it been applied in medicine?
Oh, Oh, wish. No. we can get, there's a long story. So antimicrobial resistant novel antibiotics. So we have not discovered a new antibiotic class since 1993. So what does new antibiotic class mean? It means a mechanism of action, so how something works, right? So penicillin works differently from streptomycin, that works differently from chloramphenicol. So they all have different targets in the cell. And that target specificity comes down to how they're built, right? So if you imagine antibiotics, these super complex organic molecules, they look a little bit like a spider web. And if you can imagine spider webs put together in lots of different ways, that's kind of how antibiotics look. And so those different classes have a lot of their own structures, and those structures can be patented, which is kind of important because if you're going to spend $500 million developing a drug, you want to make sure nobody else has something that looks like it, or you're working on something that looks sufficiently close to somebody else's patent, then they're not going to let you use it. So there's that. The other aspect is antimicrobial resistance, and that is, it's emerged. I mean, that's one of the big things we found in Lech, is that, you know, antimicrobial resistance was thought to have arisen in the clinic from people using antibiotics. But we found every naturally occurring mechanism resistance in Lechuguilla in places that could never have been exposed to modern antibiotics, that it had to be hardwired in, right? So, you know, one of the big takeaways from Lechuguilla is, like, you know, antibiotic resistance is way millions of years older than discovery in the clinic. So if you have a class like penicillin, you know, by the 1960s, it was starting to get to the point where you couldn't use it anymore because resistance had spread so much. It was so widespread that it basically became useless as a drug. And that's happened to class after class after class after class. And so the novel antibiotic that we found in Lechuguilla is just too much like a different class. So if we'd found something new and novel, then, you know, oh my God, I'd be rich. I'd be buying caves and donating them to conservation groups right now. But I'm not. I'm still poor. So we've changed our tactic a little bit. I mean, finding a novel antibiotic is, I think it's about as hard, even with modern technology, as looking at stars in the sky and guessing which one has a planet rotating around it. I mean, it's a needle within a haystack, and that haystack is a needle within another haystack. It's very, very difficult to do. And so I've got a lot of colleagues that I work with. They've got some high throughput systems to speed that process up. But one of the things we've started looking for now are adjuvants. And so this is something that we think, from the work we've done in Lech, we understand how antibiotics evolve. And the next step in the evolutionary process is the development of resistance. And then if you take that one step further, you have something that kills that resistance. And so that's what we're looking for now. We call them adjuvants or resistance breakers. So we've actually shifted gears, and we're looking specifically for things that break resistance. So if you imagine, trying to think of a good analogy here, it's a Game of Thrones analogy, right? Somebody's coming at you with a sword, which is the antibiotic, and you put up your shield, then the sword bounces off your shield and you're antibiotic resistance. Well, what if you, when you, that person puts up that shield, you have like a small explosive device that you slap on the front of the shield that blows the shield to pieces right before you swing the axe, the sword at them. And then they, you know, they're toast. And so that's what we're looking for, those resistance breakers, those little things that we can break the shield with. And there's some precedent for it. There's if anyone's ever taken Augmentin is penicillin with one of these resistance breakers that we call clavulanic acid. So that's what we're looking for. That's our new screen right now. And it's pretty cutting edge. There's not a lot of labs doing this. And we think caves like Lechuguilla are just packed with these things.
So how often do you make it to Lechuguilla? Is it an annual thing? Is it every couple of years? Is it more than once a year?
It depends on the year. Between October 2016 and December 2017, I did 5 trips.
Nice.
Yeah.
How many of those are like, how many of those are not science based, like survey? I'm sure
almost
that,
all of them. I've never, the thing is, everybody thinks I'm a scientist.
Well, you are.
I don't go anywhere or do anything. But I also am quite a bit of exploration in my time. So, we were in there in December, and we pushed this climb. I encouraged the climbers to attend and facilitated their activities. pushed something called the PhD Room Climb, which is supposed to be an unclimbable climb. And James Hunter and Derek Bristol did this, like, just amazing, epic climb through the worst imaginable rock. And I think they went up 210 feet. This, like, serious aid climb took them 6 days, hand drilling bolts, you know, just, like, pushing. And I knew there was huge passage up there. And, of course, it immediately died. But I do like to do it. I did a lot of exploration in Wind Cave when I was in my 20s. Probably put several miles in the book there. And then, of course, I was on the trip that discovered Cloud Ladder Hall in China, which has got to be a highlight. So,
oh, I know. Just that enormous room with its own weather and all that. I mean, grief.
Yeah, it was spectacular. It was me and Mike Futrell and Duncan Collis. And we'd been surveying. We'd found a cave, I think it was 2 years before, called, what was the name of it? It had a fortress or something, because it was the locals in China would build these fortresses across cave entrances when the Japanese would come in, and they'd hide behind them and throw things in the Japanese.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so there was this, you know, big fortress and a door in it. And we went up there. I remember I sketched the main passage, and we're surveying this thing a couple of years before, and we get to this canyon, and it's just blowing a hoolie, you know, it's just freezing cold in this thing. It's just blowing so much air. And Tommy Shiflett said, "Oh, well, I'll go check it out." And he takes a jump at this canyon and then just jumps from side to side, like left to right. And it's a big jump. It's like 5-6 feet. And there is nothing to land on. It's not like a ledge or anything. It's these tiny little nubbins. And he goes running down. He's like, "Are you coming?" Like, "Oh, hell no. I'm," you know, it's like a 30-foot drop if you miss. And I'm like, I ain't doing that. And so we left it, and they went back the next year, and they threw, there was a pit at the bottom, at the back, and they were filming it, and they were like, "Well, we're going to throw a rock." And so they threw a rock, and they didn't hear anything, so they thought it must have gone splat in the mud or something. And then they threw another rock. I'm going to do like a show and tell here. I'm going to get my watch off to do this, all right? So when I say throw, that's when they throw the rock, and then you'll just to feel how long this takes. Ready?
Okay.
Throw. Bang.
You're kidding. You're kidding. Oh, that would drive, that would drive me insane.
Oh my God. It's like, there's a video of them. It's, I don't know, we've got it somewhere. And it's just like, you can't believe how long that takes. And then you hear this almighty, like, boom, when you're like, mother of God. So we knew there was something down there. And we'd found this, the following year, we were in this river passage, and we found this. So there was a kind of the passage split, and there was a wet way and a dry way, and we'd focused on the wet way because we're just following the stream up. But then we turned to the dry way, and it actually took a lot of lead climbs to get up there. There was some pretty epic bolting by Mike Ficco to get up this thing. So we got into this dry passage and just kept going. It was bloody huge. And we're following this thing. And so we decided we're going to do a pincer movement, right? One team is going to go in with 900 feet of rope from the top, and we're going to follow in this dry passage and keep going from the bottom. And we're heading in this passage. We just keep doing, like, you know, 150-foot shots, like one after the other, and this thing just still keeps going. And we get into this one passage, and it's about 30 feet wide and about 20, 25 feet high. And it's blowing so much air, Tommy Shiflett said, "We need to rig a line and use a Jumar to go through this thing," right? and I think Mike Futrell was like, "Holy shit, we could fly a kite in this thing." So we actually went out, we got a kite, and came back in. And I took a photo of Duncan flying a kite in this this passage. And I've heard people say, well, caves are silent, you know, silent places for reflection. And this thing is go, just phenomenal thing. So anyway, we just keep going, we keep going, we're pushing. And we were surveying with Mike Futrell, and I don't know if you don't know Mike, but he doesn't like the cold. And we get to this, with this big lake, and Mike is like, I am not going through that lake. I am not getting cold. So Duncan does this traversal around the edge of the lake, and just to keep the sketcher dry. And I remember and this is going to become relevant in a minute. So we climb up about 15 feet, and then we do this like multi-bolt traverse around this corner, and then up, and we're off. And then we get into this room, and we can just see the light in the ceiling of these people coming down where they've rigged it. And they're coming down this rope, and they've had to soak the rope in water because there's going to be so much friction coming down this thing that they've got the rope soaked in water, and they're pouring water on their, you know, the stops they're using to come down this thing. And there's a knot 400 feet off the ground because they didn't have a rope long enough to go all the way to the bottom. So you're doing crossing a knot 400 feet off the ground. So we get into this big room, and it's just like, oh my God, and, you know, yelling and screaming, and, you know, they drop down and we come under, you know, we couldn't survey under, and we finish up. Just absolutely phenomenal. And we took a celebratory photo, you know, like, yay, look what we did. And I'm pulling the dumbest face because this is like one of the highlights of my caving career. And I'm pulling this stupid face in excitement. So I've never shown the photo to anyone because I look ridiculous. But so this, you know, it's fantastic. And then we leave the cave, it's all mapped. And then we come out, and we kind of map it on the surface, and we realize there's a huge sinkhole, like a sinkhole that's like quarter mile across and 2 miles long on the other side of where Cloud Ladder Hole is moving towards. And we think, oh, there's another entrance there. So I wasn't on the trip that they went looking for that entrance. Aaron and I were looking for some cave somewhere else, but they found this entrance. The entrance is 100 feet wide and 300 feet high.
Wow.
Oh, fantastic. They go in and survey. So we decide we're going to do a big survey trip. We're going to do an overnighter. We're going to do a 24-hour trip, and we're just going to see what we can get in the book. So it's me, Tommy, Mike Futrell, and Duncan. And we go in, and we're just mapping and mapping and mapping. And we get over a mile in the book on one survey trip, which is just like, I mean, and this is huge. It's just huge cave. And we're in this one lead, and we go in, and we're surveying it. And it's like, I don't know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. It's like, okay, we've had enough. Let's turn around and leave. And we come out that passage, and you can hear water. And Duncan Collis, who's like this, you know, badass guy, you know, like super badass caver, goes, uh-oh. And I've never, you know, you hear about, you know, people say your reaction to fear, like your mouth goes dry and your stomach drops. Hearing Duncan say, uh-oh, at the sound of water, like my mouth went dry. I'm like, wow, your mouth really does go dry. And then my stomach sank. I'm like, oh, that happens too. And then we looked up the passage, and this passage is about 70 feet across. And there's about a 6-foot wall of water coming towards us. And we're like, oh, we're in this dry passage that's dry. And now there's this wall of water, and we're a mile from an entrance.
Wow.
Yeah. So we just were like, well, we got to go for it. And we just were fighting, like, you know, either chest deep or swimming, pulling against boulders, using ropes. And we get to this one place, and it's a narrow spot. It's about 20 feet wide. And there's this we should have known, right? Because this thing is like carved like a big S bend. And you climb up about, I don't know, it's 5 or 6 feet into this funnel. And we should have known that meant that some major water come through there, right? I mean, all the clues are there. You should know that. But of course, now we get to it, and there is literally a fire hydrant of water coming out, except the fire hydrant's about 7 feet in diameter.
Oh, God.
And it's arcing about 20 feet, and that's the way out. And if we don't get out, we're spending 3 days up on a ledge somewhere. I remember Duncan said, I'll be back. And then he jumped over the top of this siphon onto the far side of this this kind of funnel, and then disappeared. And we didn't know where it was. And we're standing there. It's me, Tommy Shiflett, and Mike Futrell, and we're kind of looking at each other. And then this rope just drops down between us. And then we hear Duncan say, come up. And so Mike gets on rope and up he goes. And then I hear Mike yell, come up. So I get on rope. It's about a 20, 25 foot climb. And I get to the top and Duncan is straddling. He's got kind of, he's in a little alcove and he's got both arms pushing out against the alcove and both feet pushing against a rock. And Mike Futrell is lying on his stomach. And what happened is there was nothing to rig off of. So Duncan had tied the rope to himself and just wedged himself. So I like fling off my vertical gear, fling myself off on Mike Futrell. And then Tommy comes up and Tommy's like, holy shit. And then there was this ledge that we had to traverse across this thing, this maelstrom. And it was narrow. It was maybe 4 or 5 inches and it was about a 50 degree angle and there was nothing. It's just smooth, right? It was just going to be a friction climb. And if you went, that was it. There's no way that you were going to survive that fall. And it was the only way to get past this water. And at the entrance to the cave, there's a passage just like it. And I'd always ask them to rig it because you literally would do this kind of, you slide your hands against the rock, you slide your feet across the rock, you kind of get your face in it, and you're just kind of like balancing across this thing. And it's an obnoxious ledge, it's about 20, 25 feet long. And if you fell off it, you just splash in a bottle in the big pool of water. It's about 15 feet deep. And everybody would sit and watch you do it because they're waiting for you to fall off. And people peeled off this thing all the time into this big pool of water. And they wouldn't put a rope on it because they wanted to see people fall in. I remember Mike said to me, he says, we don't want a rope because we're practicing for the real thing. So we're up on top of this climb, you know, we've just done this like escape from this waterfront, and we look at this ledge and it looks exactly like this entrance thing. Everybody watches you to see if you're going to fall in. Mike turns to me and said, see, I told you it was practice for the real thing. So we had to go across this. All I can remember is just looking at Tommy and saying, well, don't let me fall. And Tommy's like, what the hell am I going to do? And so we get across this thing. And then there was a couple of places where we knew if the water went one way, we were completely stuffed, but it never quite did it. And then we got to this area where Mike had Duncan rig the traverse line, you know, it's 15 feet up in the air. I swam over to it and used it as a hand line, and it was about 2 feet underwater when I pulled myself around. So that's how deep the water had gotten in this passage. And that was right below Cloud Ladder Hall. So yeah, it was... I hate water now. Absolutely. It's happened about 3 times now. I've come close. I just absolutely bloody hate water caves now.
Okay. So you've been caving all over the world. Are there any projects going on right now that you know of that you'd like to get a piece of? Like you've heard about this and you're like, I'd like to go there.
Oh, gosh.
I'm sure there are, but I mean,
yeah.
Can you pick one out?
I don't ever want to do that, though, because... you know, I mean, it's the big name caver thing, and you get a reputation for being a certain thing. And I don't ever want to be that, you know, person who swoops in and gets the right to do something without putting the time and effort in that everybody else
understand.
Gets to put in.
Completely yeah. understand, yeah.
So, and I'm super, you know, like I hear so many stories about myself, and I was like, where the bloody hell did that come from? I'm more interested in doing it myself so that that doesn't happen. And, you know, recruiting some people that I enjoy being in the field with and doing something. So I'm not quite sure. I've got some ideas. I mean, Kazakhstan seems like that would be really cool.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, I've got some Moroccan cavers want me to come. I know the French have been doing a ton of stuff in the Atlas Mountains. So, Morocco. I love Morocco. It's a fun place to visit. And it's quite cheap. But Colombia, I know there's some folks doing stuff in Colombia. But yeah, I mean, it's all good. I mean, Africa, I think Africa's underexplored. And somebody invited me to go to Ivory Coast, but I checked out the geology and there's really, it's not promising. What I'm more interested in is like the stuff we're doing in Brazil. So I have a good friend, I didn't know him at the time, Augusto Auler. He was a Brazilian caver, and he came to the 2009 ICS meeting when it was in Texas, and he had these caves and he wanted a microbiologist to check them out. And he was checking out the microbiologist and he was looking around. He's like, well, a lot of these people don't look like they could get to the cave. And then he met me and he's like, well, you look like you could get to our caves. I was like, well, what caves are those? And they're caves formed in iron. So these are atypical rocks. So it's not carbonate. It's rock that never should form caves. So limestone dissolves at a rate of about 30 feet every million years, where the iron rock dissolves at a rate of about a foot every million years.
Wow.
So it's highly insoluble. You shouldn't get caves there. And it's one of the most cave-dense regions of Brazil. And so he invited me down. And then I get the whole thing about why, you know, he didn't think people were maybe up for doing it, because you're hacking through the jungle, you're wearing snake boots, you got killer bees. Oh my God, it's just epic. There are flooding caves, you get flooded, and yeah, it's pretty, it's like Indiana Jones stuff, and there are, you know, the insects can kill you. Anyway, it's glorious. So we get to these caves, and it's like, if you've ever seen Empire Strikes Back, when they get inside that worm, and they get off the spacecraft and the whole place seems alive. It's just like that.
Wow.
And so we're trying to understand what caves were there. And it turns out that the microbes are breathing the iron. So they're actually using the iron of the rock to breathe. And they're respiring energy from the nutrients, because it's jungle there. So there's plenty of nutrients getting into the subsurface. But the way that they're doing it, because if oxygen was around, they'd use oxygen. So it wouldn't happen if there's plenty of oxygen. So what's happening is they're actually doing it behind the walls of the cave. So you always think about caves as a conduit, like a tube that water flows through. Well, these caves form with water flowing behind the walls until the walls become so disintegrated, they just collapse in to create the cavity, and then it expands again. And so we've got, you know, we've done some pretty neat stuff with CT scans of the rock, and you can see these microbes just completely turning the wall to smush. And if you kind of take a drill, make a crack in it, you can peel it away like a massive scab, and it's just gunge behind. And this stuff just keeps continually falling in to form the cave. So instead of it, the water going through the middle of the passage, it's more like water flowing around, like down a piece of string to form these caves. And there's thousands of caves that form this way. So it's an entirely different way that caves could form. So that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in that. I'm really interested in the quartzite caves. We did a bunch of work in Venezuela, but haven't been able to get back since it got so destabilized down there. But I think quartzite, there's another story. So that's silica. I think there's a whole silica story to be told as well. So scientifically, I'm into that. I've got some cave trips coming. I'm taking a sabbatical next year, so I've got some cave trips coming up that I'm going to get a chance to go on. It's going to be great to be a caver again for a year. I've got some expeditions that I'm going to be going on, so that'll be fun. But yeah, I do worry about the whole like swooping in on somebody's trip kind of thing. Meghalaya in India would be fun. I think India, the cloud forest in India, the work they've been doing there is pretty phenomenal. I think that would be fun to do.
Oh my goodness. All right. So let's go big picture. Mm-hmm. What would you like to see serious cavers, maybe people in leadership, maybe people who just have a lot behind them experience wise, what would you like to see serious cavers doing more of?
Taking themselves more seriously.
You think so?
I think that we tend to be hobbyists, and we tend to play hobbyists, and we tend to have hobbyist level ideas. I think the time has come when we should be recognized as a serious science, and we should recognize ourselves as serious scientists. And I think recreational cavers who do survey or inventory of any of that stuff should stop calling themselves recreational cavers and start calling themselves cave scientists. I really think that the image problem we have is inside of ourselves, is that we don't take ourselves seriously enough. I think that we're getting to the point. I just got elected to the American Academy of Microbiology a couple of weeks ago as a cave microbiologist, and that's never happened before. And so, well, actually, Norm Pace is a member of the Academy, but he got it for his other work. So, like, it's getting recognized as a serious science, and we should do ourselves the favor of taking ourselves seriously and stop thinking it's just a hobby, that this stuff is going to matter a lot more. Caves are a really important avenue to study interactions in the subsurface, and with climate change, there's a lot of changes in how the surface of the earth talks to the interior of the earth, and that's that critical zone, and caves are part of that critical zone. And so I like to think cave microbiology is coming into its own as a science, but I think that could probably be true for caving. Is like it's going to start to be recognized, not as like these strange people that like to crawl around in the dirt, but like some serious stuff going on. I think if you look at what happened with the Thai cave rescue, you know, with the British cavers and the Australian cavers, you know, the recognitions and awards and everything they've gotten in their countries, it's recognizing that this is, you know, some serious stuff going on here. These are people that really know what they're doing.
It's so refreshing to hear that and to hear you answer it so quickly, to hear that is important to you. Like, yeah, this is fun and this is different and this is weird, but you know what? We're the only ones doing this, so we might as well take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's some weird politics. There's a cave in, you know, I work in Lechigi a lot, and it's a fun cave. And the reason I'm good at cave science is because I've spent so much time caving for fun that I'll be in a passage and I'll sit down and I'll look and I'll spot something is different, because I've seen a lot of caves, so I know what is different. And as a microbiologist, that's something I can target. And so never underestimate the value of just doing something because you enjoy it. You don't know when you're going to need that. I mean, if I was just a scientist interested in caves and I wasn't doing the kind of caving I'm doing, I could never ask those kind of questions, because everything would just look alien to me. Whereas I know when something is different, and I know I can key in on that. And then you see, you know, there's this big argument, and it did affect Lechigi to some extent, is that, you know, well, we shouldn't have exploration because, you know, you guys are damaging the cave. I mean, you know, we camp in Lech and we got a waste issue and all of this, and you're damaging the environment. Well, if that cave wasn't mapped the way it's mapped, where we have a really good idea of how the cave interacts with the structural geology around it, I couldn't do my science. The only way I can do such good science in there is because there's 150 miles of mapped passage. And you see that in Barrancas. So the Barrancas is a cave in the national forest there. And there's a memorandum of understanding that says that science has to be done first. Exploration has to follow science. Well, it's a big, deep, difficult cave. How many scientists are going to be wanting to lead before the researchers, right? And you give, you know, your average scientist with a plastic tube is not going to want to be rigging and pushing a pit to see if there's good science at the bottom of it, right? They're going to be following the people who've done that. So Lechigi is what, 150 miles or close to 147 miles now. And Barrancas, I think, is still less than two. And that memorandum of understanding has been in place for 20 years because you're not letting explorers explore. And the only way I can do science is because of all the work that's gone before. And that might be a bit self-serving because I'm also an explorer and I enjoy doing that. But maybe that's why I see the value in it as well.
It seems like you do indeed value exploration over almost all else. I mean, that was what your TED Talk was about.
Yeah, it was so much fun.
Well,
I mean,
sure.
Honestly, I found so much cool stuff. I mean, we found the lunatic fringe in Wind Cave, which wasn't supposed to exist. It's the only rope drop in Wind Cave, and it's called the lunatic. I mean, it's like rappelling into a cathedral. It's a huge room, and every surface has got frostwork. So no matter what direction you look, it's sparking back at you. So you drop 60 feet down into this thing, and I remember landing on the ground and looking around, and there's all this sediment around me. There's no bloody footprints, right? So it's like, my footprints are going to be the first footprints. Well, where else can you get to do that? And we were just like, there were passages going off everywhere. I think it was like 2 miles a cave or something like back there. And just bloody passages in every direction. So we're all like running off and checking stuff. And what was it? We came back, we start surveying, and we keep forgetting to like do back sites or write things in the book or do inventory because we're so ecstatic about what we found that we turned into a bunch of lunatics. So yeah, so lunatic fringe.
So even bigger picture here, as we come to a close, and I appreciate your time tonight. You've said what individual cavers can do and to make things better, and that's to take themselves more seriously. What can the community as a whole do better?
Encourage the participation of young people, I think. So the next generation, and this is something that everybody has noticed we're suffering from. And there are, I think I'm starting to see a new wave come in. We need to be very inclusive. I think that the community has had a sexual harassment problem that has definitely been a problem the entire time I've been going to conventions. You know, the number of times I've been groped or cornered or things like that at convention. And you know, I'm a fairly big woman and I I don't have any problem pushing back, but I shouldn't need to do that, right? No. And so we have these young, attractive women who have lots of potential and lots of talent, and they're showing up, and some guy who's, some old codger who doesn't get a lot of attention feels it's appropriate to say things to that girl. Well, she's never going to come back. I mean, she's never going to get the joy out of watching someone give a talk about Mexico and the deep stuff in Mexico and imagine themselves in that situation and then a few years later find themselves doing that. I mean, we're going to lose that. So I think that's something that we as a group, and it's easy to do. I'm the chair of the Committee for the Status of Women in Microbiology for the American Society of Microbiology. And we have the same issue, right? It's not exclusive to caving conventions. I've had my butt groped in at the American Society for Microbiology general meeting. And we just were like, with the Me Too movement, it's like, look, you guys now get that this is for real. We should be doing something about it. So we had a meetings policy, and basically it's like, we're not tolerant of this. If you do it, we're going to kick you out. And what happens is people realize that it gets taken seriously, and it doesn't take long for people to realize this is not the avenue for that kind of behavior, and it stops. So I think we need to be encouraging people. We need to be inclusive, and part of that inclusivity includes giving people the opportunity to enjoy it as much as we've enjoyed it. And I was lucky, I had a really good group of people around me when I was younger, and we were all together, and we'd have a big joke about, old pervy this or old pervy that. But, it's a bit different now. People don't feel it's acceptable behavior, and it will turn people off. So I think that is something we should address, is how do we bring young people in, maintain those future generations. I mean, there's a lot of really good people out there now. Arya Mildais and Nick Saki, and you just start rattling off these names. These are going to be amazing cavers in a few years. I'm just really excited that I get to see them coming into the field and just how good and talented they are. And I want to see more of that.
Well, I'm really glad that you addressed that and indeed identified that as an issue, because it's an issue, not, like you said, not just in caving, but all over. And I'm really glad that you brought it into the caving spotlight. And I have a grotto that, I mean, you and I kind of talked numbers before we talked tonight, and you said you got started at a time when it was 20-1 men to women. I really kind of see that as sort of still the case in certain areas. And the women who hang around are the tougher ones, but it should be all women who have any sort of interest in this.
Right. And then there's the, I mean, it didn't happen to me much, but it did. I mean, I used to love it, right? It wasn't so much the attention, but I felt like I needed to be as tough as, right? So I was really bloody tough in my 20s because I had to be able to prove that I was as tough as the guys. And I lost my femininity a bit,
And that's kind of a defense, right?
Yeah. It wasn't. I just wanted to be equal, right? And then it was actually the IMAX and hanging out with Nancy, and I was tough and I was strong and I had the pants on and all this kind of stuff. And then, it didn't matter how clever and smart I was. Nancy had these people just, fawning over her and just beck and call. And I was like, what is she doing differently? And when she was just allowed to be a girl. And I was like, oh, I can do that. I kind of like being a girl. I like doing my hair and I like wearing heels. And it was, I know people have to keep giving me permission to be that, but I think Nancy gave me permission to just be a girl again. And that was fantastic. But at the same time, that doesn't mean if a girl shows up to an expedition and, you know, she's attractive and she takes care of herself. Just because she's there, it doesn't mean she's looking for a boyfriend. And I think you need to think about that. If there's a girl and she's attractive, enjoy the fact that there's an attractive young woman on the caving trip with you. Don't feel that that means that she's there because she's looking for a boyfriend. She's probably there just to go caving. And, you know, respect that.
Let that happen. Well, fair enough. All right. So to wind down, I have one more thing, and I don't want to turn this into a line of conversation into a gear comparison or anything like that, but I am curious. What is in Dr. Hazel Barton's day pack? Snacks, luxury items?
I'll tell you what you need to have, and you need a Biffy bag in your day pack.
Okay.
You absolutely have to have a – do you know these things?
No, I guess not.
So we did a National Geographic documentary in La Chiquilla in 2016. And, you know, in Lech, yeah,
what,
when you
what
have
was
to,
it called? I've seen, I saw the segment. I can't remember. Will Smith hosted it, right?
Yeah, it was One Strange Rock.
There we go.
So it was Genesis. It was the Genesis episode. And so anyway, you know, when you have to do a number two, you do your number one in a bottle and you have to do your number two separately. And what you would do is you make these burritos, right? And so it's a big joke, a big piece of foil.
Right.
You do it on there, you roll it up and you put it in a Ziploc bag and then you double bag it. And it looks like a big Ziploc burrito. And I've been doing this for years. And the film crew showed up with these Biffy bags, which are like serious luxury items. And I'm like scoffing like, oh, these things, what a waste of time. But they're kind of this thick foil that doesn't let the air out. And if you open it up, there's like a big bag liner in it. And it's filled with this powder. And I've forgotten what the polymer is, but it absorbs like 10,000 times its volume or something of liquid. So the idea is you can do number one and number two at the same time. You bag it up and take it out. And this is what the film crew was doing. And I spent an awful lot of time shoving these bags in Darren drums so that the Sherpas could get them out of the cave. But anyway, I used one and I realized that you could open it up again and use it again. So in like a burrito bag, you use it one time and you're done. With these things, you could kind of open it up and use it again. You can get 4 days in there, which is, I know, really gross and everybody's going to be disgusted. But think about the weight savings, right? Instead of like four packets, you've got these burrito bags and they've got this gel in the bottom. So I've just started carrying them in my caving pack because they're so useful, right? If somebody gets sick. Well, one of my students, we were caving about 2 weeks ago, and she had decided to party the night before we're going to go surveying, which is fine, but we're still going surveying. I don't care what time you went to bed. I don't care how much bourbon you drank. So we're in the cave, and about 5 o'clock, she's like, I'm going to throw up, going to throw up. And she threw up into a Ziploc, and we've got like 2 liters of vomit. It's like, how the hell are we going to get this out, right? So I'm like, Biffy bag. So I open this thing up and we pour it in. It instantly gels. And then I pack this bag down and I'm going through these crawls and I'm crawling in my pack like, oh, I hope this thing doesn't. No problem whatsoever. So it's great for human waste. It's great for vomit. And I just thought the irony was when I was a graduate student in my advisor's lab, you know, he sat me down and told me that caving was going to distract me from my science and I was never going to be successful. In the Barton lab, the graduate student throws up and the boss carries it out the bloody cave.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Everybody should have a Biffy bag.
Biffy bag.
Biffy bags all around. Fantastic devices.
Mark it down. How can you find that?
just Google it. Biffy. Yeah, and there's just a company, a little company that does these things. Just amazing. You're. It's like the most life changing. And honestly, this life changing. Because waste handling in Lech is a big deal, right? If you get sick,
of course.
Like you can go in and plan. Well, I've got 7 days, and then if I need an extra, I've got 8. Well, if someone gets sick, they're going to blow through 5 of those bags in one day, and then what do you do for the rest of the week? So. Yeah. It's kind of like extra storage and it takes the pressure off and they're just damn convenient to use. They're very comfortable. But yeah, Biffy bags are the way to go. 100% luxury item. Yeah.
Oh, well, Dr. Barton, I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been great information. Is there anything else you want to share?
Yeah, don't call me Dr. Barton.
I have to. No. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Look, if I had spent all that time getting a PhD, I would want to be called Dr. Pelser, but I'm not, so I have to do
really?
It to you, all right?
No, this is... I did it because it was fun.
Well, thank you again. I appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for thinking of me.
Wow. What a great caving representative. Thank you for your time, Hazel. Dr. Barton, sorry I had to do it one more time. And thank you for listening. I'm happy to announce that someone we talked about in this episode will be my guest next month, her mentor, Norm Pace. Look for that August 1st, give or take a few days. I can't guarantee that I'll have it out that day, though, because that's when my kid is due, and I may or may not be done editing it by then, and I want my focus to be on my wife and my family. So I appreciate your understanding if we don't get it out exactly on August 1st. Support the podcast by supporting Caving. Donate to your grotto or the NSS or Karst Conservancy, specifically this month, the Michigan Karst Conservancy. Also, thank you for your support at convention. Those of you who asked for Caving podcast stickers and t-shirts, thanks for giving Charlie some business at convention. You can always support the podcast by buying Swago packs, too. They were our very first sponsor, and that love continues. Hey, thanks for listening. I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.